A shocking statistic. One in 100 U.S. adults are in prison. The 1% threshold was crossed with a continued rise in incarceration rates, says a new study, and as you might expect, are only worse when you look at the rates for black and Hispanic men at 1 in 15 and 1 in 36, respectively. This report was issued by the Pew Center on the States, and its project director, Adam Gelb, joins me now. Also to look at how New York's numbers compare to the national average is Michael Jacobson, director of the Vera Institute for Justice, a nonprofit policy research center here in New York. Welcome both of you to WNYC today. Hello.
Hi. Good morning.
Adam Gelb, let's look at some of these numbers a little more closely. 1 in 9 adult black men under 35 in prison, for example. What other groups did you look at?
Well, we looked at the broad range of demographics and found that there's an extremely high rate of incarceration for black women in their late 30s. The black women also incarcerated now at a rate of 1 in 100, which is really stunning because the incarceration rate for women has been so much lower than for men over the years, but women are catching up.
But in their late 30s, that's older than for the man in general.
That's right. Women tend to commit a number of crimes before they're locked up. The crimes are generally not as serious, and therefore, when they do get to prison, they tend to be older.
What's really new here? We've known that the United States has probably the highest incarceration rate of any Western democracy for years and years and years. So what do you think you found that's really new?
Well, what's really new is that state lawmakers around the country are starting to call time out. They've seen the skyrocketing costs, and they're not seeing the benefit in terms of reduced crime. And no question, some of the prison expansion has helped reduce violent crime. There's no question about that, but not nearly as much as one might expect from all the additional expense. You know, 20 years ago, states spent about $12 billion on corrections, and that number is now up to just shy of $50 billion. And for all that additional spending, state lawmakers, Republican and Democrat alike, are saying, and you know, scratching their heads and saying, you know, we haven't gotten our bang for our buck here. We really need to consider alternatives.
And before we bring in Michael Jacobson from the Vera Institute, do you have a good percentage on how many of these inmates are in for nonviolent offenses? Adam, that's for you, too.
Sure. It is. Nationally speaking, the percent of prison inmates who have a nonviolent offense is just less than half. And that means so just more than half are in for a current violent offense. That number in the early 80s was about 60%. And through the 80s and early 90s, with lots more incarceration for property offenders and drug offenders in particular, that slid down to under 50%. So under 50% of the prison population was violent offenders. It started to creep back up again now, in large part because of three strikes measures and other laws that do keep violent offenders in the system longer. So they are stacking, and most people would say that's good. They should be. Those are exactly the type of people we want prison cells for.
Michael Jacobson, am I right that New York was one of the few states where the prison population is actually dropping?
Yeah, New York's an interesting example, especially given the report that Adam is talking about, because it's actually the fastest shrinking prison population in the country. That's been true since about 1999, so for the last 8 years or so. It's been almost a 14 or 15% decline in the entire size of the system. And the New York City jail system actually mirrors that same trend. And what's interesting both about the city and state examples is that while New York State and New York City have the fastest sort of declining either prison or jail populations in the country, New York State and New York City also lead the country in state crime declines and city crime declines, respectively. So it's very counterintuitive, and it sort of bucks the general national trend.
So do you blame or credit the chicken or the egg? In other words, are people going to prison less in New York because there is less crime, or does our prison policy have something to do with it?
Well, you know, it's a very good question, and there are a lot of answers to that. Both to how the NYPD uses its resources, they've really bumped up nonviolent and quality of life arrests over the last several years, and those folks don't even have the opportunity to go to prison. But what's happening in New York, in fact, in a lot of ways, should be happening around the country. That is, there's much, much less crime in New York, especially in the city, where violent crime is down about 70 to 75% from its highs. And when there's less crime and less violent crime, you should have fewer people going to prison. So in a lot of ways, what's happening in New York makes sense. It's simply that when you look around the country, right, the rest of the country over the last 10 years has had a crime decline as well. But other states keep sending more and more people to prison, even with crime declines. And as crime goes down, as the number of arrests go down to match crime going down, there should be fewer people cycling into prison. But that's not what you see happening in most of the rest of the country.
Listeners, we can take your phone calls, your reactions or questions about the United States for the first time hitting a 1% incarceration rate. One out of every 100 Americans now behind bars for the first time, and some of the other statistics, both locally and nationally, that we're talking about with Adam Gelb from the Pew Center on the States, which conducted the survey, and Michael Jacobson, director of the Vera Institute for Justice. 212-433-WNYC is our phone number, 212-433-9692, or post a comment to our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Michael just mentioned this correlation between crime going down and prison populations going up nationwide. And in the New York Times, I think in correlation with, in conjunction with publishing the results of your study, Adam Liptak interviewed a judge who points to this corresponding drop in crime rates that accompanied the rise in prison populations and argues that, well, maybe this is a good thing because you'd rather have more people in prison and fewer people committing crimes than the other way around. Do you reject the correlation?
Oh, not at all. There's no question not only that violent and career criminals deserve to be punished and deserve to be off the streets, but that there is a correlation between locking up those kind of criminals and lowering the crime rate. And you know, Mike Jacobson at Vera and others have done studies of this and attribute about 25% of the crime drop in the 90s to increased incarceration. The issue is this: it is not that prisons don't reduce crime; it's that other things do too. And policymakers have an obligation to look at all the options and deliver the taxpayers the best return on their dollar. So, you know, that comment looks at only half the equation. You have people at the other end of the pool, the shallow end, particularly probation and parole violators, people who have failed to show up for a treatment appointment or had a dirty drug test, and absolutely they need to be held accountable. But most taxpayers would you know, not like to pay $24,000 a year for a prison cell for that kind of person any more than they want to pay for, say, a bridge to nowhere.
So what are the state's options if they don't want the crime rate to rise, but, you know, don't want to pay for don't want to send all these people to prison?
Well, I think as Adam was saying, you know, going forward, right, there's almost total sort of expert and research consensus that expanding prison populations will get you very little in terms of public safety, because you're just going to keep putting more and more marginal folks in terms of their risk to public safety in prison. But there's a whole host of research that shows a variety of other things, whether it's certain kinds of policing strategies, increasing high school graduation rates, targeting labor markets for hard-to-employ and disconnected youth, alternative to incarceration programs, community-based sanctions. There are a whole host of interventions, some in criminal justice and some not, that in pure public safety terms get you much more bang for your buck than prison. So one of the reasons there are so many people in prison is that what we've done in this country over the last 30 or 40 years is we've defaulted immediately to prison as the punishment or sanction of choice. But in fact, the research now shows, the evidence-based research shows, that if you want to increase public safety, there are a whole host of policy interventions you can do that will work better than prison, and they also happen to be a lot cheaper than prison.
Brian?
I'll just add to that, Brian.
Go ahead, Adam.
Yes, that high-quality pre-kindergarten is a very strong long-term crime prevention strategy. It's so strong, in fact, that there is a network of law enforcement chiefs, police chiefs, and law enforcement professionals from around the country who have banded together as in a network called Fight Crime, Invest in Kids. And they realize that that we are seeing diminishing marginal returns, as Mike just said, on incarceration, and we've got to start as early as we can.
Brian in Bridgeport, you're on WNYC. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Brian. I really like your show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to comment on what I think it was Adam just said about intervening at an early age. I work in juvenile probation, and I think if we could get services in place for so many of our clients earlier, we wouldn't be seeing them in the courts. But what I wanted to say was, in Connecticut, we've used a system of home-based services over the past 5 years, evidence-based services, that have drastically reduced the number of juveniles who wind up going to our training school, the Connecticut Juvenile Training School, or any other placement. These have worked pretty well. We place only, I think, about 300 juveniles per year now, and we were placing almost 1,000. And again, in terms of taxpayer payoff, it just doesn't work. It costs a lot of money to place a child, and the recidivism rates once they got out were very, very high.
Yeah, and that's true not only in Connecticut, but nationwide. And although the report itself concentrated on adults, you're absolutely right that the juvenile recidivism rate for juveniles placed in either, it can be called placements or secure facilities or juvenile prison, it costs a fortune. It can cost up to $100,000 and $200,000 a year. And nationally, you see recidivism rates of 70 to 90%. And a lot of states, like Connecticut, are looking at that and realizing, in terms of Adam's sort of bang for the buck analogy, you're just not buying a lot of success. And again, we know there are community-based programs that for a lot of these kids, not all, but a lot, will protect public safety, will result in fewer victims than just continually sending kids to secure confinement and then having them return 8 out of 10 times.
212-433-WNYC on the first ever 1% incarceration rate for the United States population. And Sarah in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Excuse me. I'm wondering if they've done comparison to incarceration rates in other countries, and if there's been discussion, there has been, of whether our current high rate correlates to the huge disparity of income between rich and poor in our country.
Adam?
Well, there has been some study, probably not enough, but what it has shown is two things. One, we have a higher incarceration rate because we do have a higher rate of violent crime. So again, there's some justification for our being out of whack there, not a complete justification, but some. And the second point is that we do have much harsher sentencing laws and policies, particularly for property and drug offenders.
Why is that?
Yes, that's a policy preference. It's the decisions that this country started to make in the late 70s, early 80s, and through the 1980s.
How about how it goes back in the history of this country, as a capitalist society, and how we how our justice system worked? I mean, I'm not really standing on any particular side. I'm just curious if this is something that goes back in the way we think about how punishment is to be meted out, perhaps even our Puritan background, and to some degree. I mean, I don't know if that's getting too broad.
Right, maybe Wild West background, people coming because they wanted, I don't want to say freedom and correlate that with crime, like Donald Rumsfeld did when the looting started in Iraq. But, how far back do we go?
Well, the issue is, and it's hard to remember because it hasn't been that long, up until the 60s, the United States incarceration rates were in line with, all the rest of the countries in sort of Western Europe or sort of modern democracies. We weren't out of line at all. In a lot of ways, we were lower than a lot of countries. It's really only been the last 40 years, as crime has become so politicized and hyper-politicized and has become an issue on which rests a huge amount of political capital, did we start to drive up incarceration rates the way we did. So it doesn't go back hundreds of years in terms of how many people we put in prison for how long. It's a relatively recent experiment, and it's an experiment that has resulted in mass imprisonment that buys you less and less public safety, that incarcerates huge disproportionate amounts of people of color. And at this point, it really doesn't work. And there's sort of a huge consensus on this. You know, the interesting thing about this issue now is that there's not a lot of expert debate about this. There's still political debate, but there's almost no academic experts who say what we need to do is keep putting more people in prison and we'll be safer, because it's just not true and the research is in.
And here's a post on our comments page that says, what kind of country is this? So communist China has less people in jail than the U.S.? This is scary and a disgrace. If one in every 100 adults is in jail, this means that it's much easier to wind up in jail. The Soviets probably had less in jail. So if you live in a country with a dictator, you have a better chance of not being in jail. The land of the free? Adam, interesting comparison.
It is, and that listener is not the only one who's making those kind of judgments. It is something that is really striking a chord in this country. But I guess I'd have to say, or Woody Allen might say, you know, this is as much as a shock as this is coming to some people. It should not be a surprise, because it has been building for 20, 25 years now. The result of harsher sentencing policies, restrictive release policies for parole, and an increasing preference for taking minor probation violators and parole violators and putting them in prison. Nobody wants to be responsible for something when it goes wrong, and that's certainly understandable, both for parole and probation officers, for judges, for prosecutors, right on up the scale. The news here, again, though, a little bit less so than crossing this psychological threshold, is what Mike just said, which is that there's a strong consensus, not only in the expert world, but increasingly, and certainly not reached a turning point or tipping point here, but increasingly across the country among state policymakers, people who have to balance their budget, not like the federal government that can print money, but states that have to balance their budget, saying we are out of whack here. This spending is crowding out other priorities. It's not giving us a bang for the buck, and we need to do things differently.
We'll continue in a minute. We'll take our next call from a retired parole officer up in Greene County, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we talk about the new statistic from a Pew Center for the State study that for the first time, one in every 100 U.S. adults is in prison, and also the increasing concern about from the states that's just too much, and it's costing the states more money than it's really worth. Adam Gelb is with us from the Pew Center on the States, the project director for the survey, and from the Vera Institute for Justice, Michael Jacobson. And let's take another phone call. Ken in Greene County, up toward Albany in New York. You're on WNYC. Hi, Ken.
Hi, good morning. I'd like to start by saying that Mr. Jacobson has incredible credibility. So let me leave it at that. I just know that the man is very good.
You know his previous work?
Very well.
Okay.
Question one I had is, how are they defining custody? Is it actual physical custody, or does it expand to community supervision? And I, speaking as someone whose father was incarcerated for 18 months when I was a boy, I've seen both sides of the fence, as it were. And thirdly, I wonder if either gentleman is familiar with the early days of the Narcotic Addiction Control Commission in New York, which was a somewhat experimental attempt to treat drug offenders as medical problems and not criminal problems. And I'll hang on, if I may.
Sure. Michael Jacobson, since he gave you such a nice shout-out, you can answer his question.
Sure. Well, he's right. The narcotic addiction treatment stuff, which happened in New York City a while ago, was geared, as a lot of these programs were across the country decades ago, to treat drug use medically as opposed to criminally. And, again, when you look at what's happened, going back to the Pew Report, over the last 30 or 40 years, you know, about 30 years ago, there was probably next to no one in a state prison in this country for drug use or drug possession or sale charges, absent, you know, sort of a few big kingpins, right? But that's not who you see in prison for the most part. It's low-level dealers. And now there's probably about 250,000 to 300,000 people in state prisons who are there for drug use, drug sale, drug possession. So that it's been one of the big drivers of our prison population. And again, the research on this shows, since there's so little drug treatment generally in prisons, is that people come in addicted, people leave addicted, people go back to drug use, and that's why, as Adam mentioned, parole officers cycle them back in when they start using again and fail. So you don't get a lot of success from those folks, but you get a lot of expense, and that's why you see a number of states, Kansas, California, and Proposition 36, big, tough on crime, conservative states in a lot of ways, opting for drug treatment for a number of these kinds of folks in lieu of prison. You know, prison is a very expensive, very punitive, and in a lot of cases, very damaging resource to the people it puts in. So you want to use it parsimoniously, you want to use it carefully, and if you overuse it, which we do, you will actually wind up causing more harm than good.
Matthew in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, Brian. In response to one of the last callers was asking about the roots of this kind of incarceration that we have now, and what I've come to notice from looking at it a little bit, and it was really scary, is that it started right after the Civil War and right after slavery was outlawed, and it's just a scary fact, and I'm really glad that you're bringing this up on a bigger stage.
In fact, Michael Moore in Bowling for Columbine even draws a connection between slavery and violent crime in America. Adam Gelb, you want to go there?
Well, actually, where I'd like to go is basketball.
Basketball.
Because you could point to a lot of milestones in the country's history as to what's responsible for getting us to where we are, but the death of Len Bias would certainly be right up there. Here you had the University of Maryland student graduate and right and die from a cocaine overdose.
Right.
And Tip O'Neill was the Speaker of the U.S. House at the time and a big Boston Celtics fan. And
the
Celtics had drafted Len Bias, and he was going to return the Celtics to their past glory. And when Len Bias dropped dead from a cocaine overdose, they in Congress substantially jacked the penalties for crack cocaine. That disparity, which is obviously back in the news today, as the U.S. Sentencing Commission starts to try to pull back from the disparity that was created. But that sent a very powerful political signal across the country about how this should be dealt with.
And just to follow up for a second on the issue of race, and you know, Adam pointed out, and you pointed out too, I think, at the beginning, the incredible disparity between blacks and whites in our prison system. You know, the incarceration for blacks is roughly seven times that for whites. And I think the latest Department of Justice statistic is if you're a black male baby boy born today in the United States, if these rates don't change at all, you have a 1 in 3 chance in your lifetime of spending some time in prison. And that's just a disgrace. It's a huge social problem that, as you know, as we've been saying, you know, that needs attention. And the good news here, as Adam was just saying, is there is a lot of ferment in states. There is a lot of attention to this, even in big conservative states where crime's always been a tough issue. States are taking a second look at this, and Texas just did this and is trying to turn their system and one from geared around punishment to rehabilitation, because we have too many people in prison. It doesn't get you enough public safety for the money we spend, and the issue of race and how disproportionately we use prison just can't be ignored.
Ali in Clifton, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ali.
Hello, Brian. How are you?
Okay, thank you.
I just have one simple question from your book, Beth. If you look at the Middle East countries, which they have a drug problem like here because of proximity to Afghanistan and what they call South Asia route that goes to Europe, there is a very strict policy. The big drug dealers will be executed. If they get caught and a certain amount of drugs, they will be executed right on the spot. There will be no system of justice. And the low level, they will be treated as a drug addiction. Therefore, there is not a problem of burden of having a jails or race issues between black and white. None of these things. I don't understand why nobody invests. Think about that. If you make an example of a couple of major dealers, which we don't make in this country, then you don't have these drug problems. And I want to ask your expert, why we do not create a harsh system for major drug dealers? Instead of putting them in a federal jail, make an example of them. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. That's the question I have, and I let you go.
Well, you know, I think the correlation in this country is because I don't think we're just ready to execute drug dealers on the spot. Well, maybe some are, but I think as a country we're probably not. But the fact is, you know, for big high-level drug dealers, for sort of the so-called kingpins, those folks spend a very long time in prison, as they well should, right? So we dole out for when those people are caught and punished. They don't go in and out of prison, right? Drug kingpins can spend years and even the rest of their life in prison. It's the low level, right? It's the sort of street corner dealers, the low level users, that present the biggest issue, because they spend relatively small amounts of time in prison, a year or two or maybe three. They come out worse than when they went in. And then, not surprisingly, they have incredibly high recidivism rates or parole violation rates and go back in. That's the area, and especially in a number of states where states are starting to take a second look at how we handle those folks. And again, pure public safety terms, there are better things to do than we do with them now.
We're just out of just about out of time, but on that question of the states taking a second look, somebody posted on our comments page an excerpt from a New York Times article from January that says Governor George Pataki tried to close prisons in New York each fiscal year from 2002 to 2006, but he faced intense pressure from upstate legislators and union leaders who are now already objecting to Governor Eliot Spitzer's proposal. Do you know that to be true, Michael?
Yeah, it's a very politicized issue, and it's the right thing to do in a lot of ways, to try to shrink the size of your prison system and devote money other places. But you know, a lot of these correctional facilities are in small, distressed upstate communities. They're very tied, at least a perceived tie, to economic development, and it's a political fight, and it is a difficult issue. It's the right thing to do to try to close prisons, but at the same time, the state does have to take care of those communities that have become, in some ways, if not dependent, certainly reliant on those jobs. There just have to be other jobs for those communities. And especially if you have a state where your prison population is going down so significantly, I think the governor is right to start looking to close prisons. It's the right thing to do, especially in tough economic times.
That's the prison industrial complex that you just described. That's real, really, as a jobs program, not for the prisoners, but for those outside, that could actually encourage more incarceration.
Right. And, you know, there have been a few studies that show that the perceived economic development benefits of these prisons is not as great as people think. But there's no question they do provide jobs. They do provide secondary and tertiary industries in places where prisons spring up. And that's a real thing. And for distressed communities, you understand why they get so upset.
All right.
But again, there are other forms of economic development, and prison building should not be the first form we default to when you think about what we need to do for distressed, poor, mostly rural communities.
Michael Jacobson, director of the Vera Institute for Justice. Adam Gehl, project director at the Pew Center on the States, which reported that one in 100 U.S. adults are in prison, the 1% threshold crossed for the first time. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.